The following is a presentation of the Matt Talk Podcast Network.
Welcome to On the Mat. I am Kyle Klingman of the National Wrestling Hall of Fame Dan Gable Museum, along with the man who shattered the mold, Andy Hamilton of TrackWrestling.com. How does it feel to be part of that elite group that broke barriers and shattered a mold of journalism?
I shattered the mold, huh?
Yeah. We've been listening to this. Tim Tebow video. You got me onto this, so it's your fault.
Shane Sparks got me onto it in Cleveland. But we like to pull up the Bart Scott.
Explain the Bart Scott video and how you got me hooked on that.
I don't even remember how we got hooked on the Bart Scott video. I don't even remember. Do you remember the origin?
Well, you had said when you first came here and had your office, you said, have you seen the Bart Scott video? And I didn't even really know who Bart Scott was at the time. And so you showed me the original, and then there's a mashup of this Bart Scott video of him talking after beating the Patriots. He played for the Jets, and it's just this unbelievable mashup. And the only one that really rivals that is the Stephen A. Smith, Skip Bayless, Tim Tebow.
Unleash
mashup.
Tim Tebow.
Yeah.
Let him go. It's time.
What would the wrestling mashup be? Do we have a quote that could be used? I would like to think it's Tom Brands. I think he is the most quotable.
It could be. It could be something with Gilman.
It could be Gilman. I think we have two Iowa guys there, so it says something about that program that they're quotable in the Iowa wrestling program. Not sure what other quotes come to mind, but I think a wrestling mashup is in order. And maybe there has been one. I'm just not recollecting what it is, Andy.
Yeah, I don't know. Nothing that rivals Bart Scott or Unleash Tim Tebow, though.
I know we have a couple favorites.
So what you're saying is let him go. It's time.
Yeah,
it's time.
It is. But hey, we've enjoyed Tom Brands' press conferences as
much
as any. He does. I like his flair, his flavor. He brings a lot of energy and focus to the press conferences he has. And I enjoy that as much as I enjoy the wrestling meets. I think he's good.
Yeah, absolutely. Always keeps you on your toes, right?
Well, we're going to keep you on your toes still. Not you necessarily, but the audience, because an ongoing theme is for us to consider the ongoing scoring system that we have. Right now, we're saying it's a bit out of date, and we've been giving you data. If this is your first time listening, what we're saying is that for dual meet scoring, we think it should be cumulative. So if you win by 5 points, you get 5 points for your team. If you lose by five, you lose 5 points for your team, or you get whatever points you scored in a particular match. Yeah. You get 22 points for a fall because of the technical fall rule, which if you're up by 14, you could get a 6 point move. If it's at the end of the match, you could get an extra writing time point, which gives you 21 points. So you have to have more for a fall than you do for the maximum amount for a technical fall, which would be 22. We've given you some just random data on some wrestlers throughout the country in college wrestling. We decided to just go with the top eight in a weight class. So why not start with the lightest weight class at 125 pounds? I think the numbers are really indicative of who these wrestlers are. Started with Spencer Lee, 14.5. And that doesn't rival Zane Rutherford because there's a couple losses on there, but it's pretty close. Zane Rutherford had that magic 17, which is a 2 points over the maximum for a tech fall. 14.5 really showed you how dominant Spencer Lee was throughout the season.
Absolutely. And as we put these numbers together, you don't see guys widening the gap or adding to their margin in mid-March. Spencer Lee, when you look at what he did at the NCAA championships, some tech falls in there, a couple falls on Friday. He added to that number in Cleveland.
Yeah, after the Tomasello loss at the Big Ten tournament, look at this, 12, 16, 18, 18, 22, 22, and then 4 in the NCAA championship finals against the guy who went into the finals undefeated. those are all postseason matches. Like you say, you usually don't see those numbers accumulate and pick up. He had his best numbers at the end of the season.
He's the second high right now behind Zane, right? He's the second highest.
Second highest we've seen so far.
Yep.
We go down. Hey, Nick Soriano had a nice stat too. He has an 11, had one loss on the season. As we said, he went in undefeated into the finals, and a lot of people picked him to win the NCAA tournament. Of course, the transfer from Penn State had his first crack at being in the NCAA championships after suffering that injury last season. Put up a nice season.
Yeah, absolutely. And 25-0 going into the championship match against Spencer Lee. Dealt with some more injuries late in the season. Overcame those and managed to have a heck of a tournament up until the finals there, where he kind of ran into the buzzsaw that everybody else that got in Spencer Lee's way did in Cleveland. And we've talked about that too. Just Spencer was so impressive prior to the NCAA championships. Then he took off that knee brace and he's a whole different animal in Cleveland.
Nathan Tomasello from Ohio State faced his injuries throughout the season. It was an injury shortened season, but when he came back, he had a solid season, which ended up in third place. 8.5 is his number, but he got killed by that fall against Spencer Lee in the NCAA championship semifinals, but came back for third place. 8.5, still averaging in terms of what is called a major decision now, but you take that out, of course, that's going to be a lot higher.
Yeah, and I think the other thing that really hurt Nathan Tomasello was the fact that he missed a lot of early season time. And, you know, as we rattle off these numbers, as we put them together, there's a lot of 22s and 15s on up in terms of tech falls and falls early in the season, as you're not maybe seeing as much high-level competition. And Nathan Tomasello missed out on the chance to pad his stats a little bit in November and December there.
Ethan Lezak, we've gone through him. He's 8.6. Darian Cruz got fifth place with a 9.4. So Ethan Lezak was fourth place at the NCAA tournament. But overall, throughout the season, Darian Cruz had a higher point average in our point system at 9.4. And pretty indicative. We saw that with Lezak. He dropped some matches by big scores, but 8.6 is still it's still higher than the third place finisher.
Yeah, and Cruz, he only had the one loss, right? Or two losses, excuse
two,
me.
Yep.
Yeah, two at the NCAA championships, and that was it, right?
Yeah.
So Lezak had seven defeats on the season. As you mentioned, he lost a tech fall to Tomasello. He dropped a tech fall to Spencer Lee. Those hurt him a little bit, but he also ran up the score on a bunch of people as well.
Sebastian Rivera at sixth place had an 8.1, and then Ronnie Bresser had an 8.1. So the top seven in the country at 125 had an average of over 8. I think that says a lot about what happened there. And then the aberration there, Zeke Moisey from West Virginia, he was an eighth place finisher, had a 3.1, had some big losses throughout the season, but ended up back on the podium after a second place finish a couple years ago. I think eighth place finish for him was about his ceiling going into the NCAA championships. But 3.1, does that surprise you at all?
No, he had 12 defeats and he was up and down. And he's really been up and down except for that one run his freshman year at the NCAA championships where he absolutely caught fire and took out Nashawn Garrett, took out Thomas Gilman, makes the finals, gives Nathan Tomasello all he can handle in the championship match. But besides that, Zeke Moisey's kind of been a guy that's just been on the periphery. When he's been healthy, been on the periphery of, you know, a round of 12 / All-American type of performance. We've seen him drop some matches early in the season and then avenge those matches later in the year. I think of losses to like a couple early in the year to Taylor Lamont this past season. Then he comes back and beats him late in the year. But really intrigued to see what Zeke Moisey becomes in his final year at Nebraska. Can he become more consistent? Do we see the high-level performance on a more regular basis from him? And does he eliminate some of those glitches where he's getting pinned, he's getting rolled up a little bit? But upside certainly there.
And I think one thing we want to make clear on this is just a stat that we've created as a way to bring some enthusiasm into the sport and just have an understanding of what that big picture season looked like. It was our way to say, hey, there's not many statistics in wrestling. What can we create to make it more entertaining? And I think this has accomplished that just from what we've been able to do. It just does paint a picture of a statistic that isn't necessarily wins and losses. I have enjoyed doing this and seeing where things shake out.
Yeah, and we're in super small sample size still. We're talking about what we've done, 15?
Yeah, 15 at most.
Or
yeah.
So. We got a lot of data to come through yet, Kyle.
Yeah.
But it has been intriguing just to see how add up the numbers, see what they average out and what they tell us. I think we're going to learn a lot more as we go through the rest of the weight classes here and All Americans, and then we dive into maybe some of the middle of the road type of NCAA qualifiers and what that data tells us, but also looking at maybe some dual meet scores too. See if how those shake out.
We're going to learn a lot from our guest today. Matt Lindland is going to be on our show today. He's the head Greco-Roman national team coach for USA Wrestling. A guy that you've gotten to know over the years, Andy, and I think he always has good insight into the sport. Just an interesting guy, too, has a lot of interests, and we'll delve into those interests on the program today.
Yeah, there's so many different things that are intriguing about Matt Lindland. You talk about the Greco-Roman background, the MMA background, big into whitewater rafting, like competitive whitewater rafting. Seen a bunch of the world. You told me that he ran for public office at one point. Just very, very interesting dude.
We get a chance to talk with Matt Lindland. We get a chance to reflect on a tune-up for the United States in freestyle wrestling. The Yasar Dagu tournament just took place. Some mixed results, some domination, and the one that everyone wants to talk about is Jordan Burroughs against Frank Chamizo. 10-10 win from Frank Chamizo. They are now 1-1 against each other. Some controversy. I have not had a chance to watch the match. I think you have. So I'm going to give you the floor to explain what happened there and what transpired.
So Burroughs came out and scored right away. Got to Chamizo's legs. Close to scoring a takedown. Wound up being a step out point. The Burroughs corner tossed the brick. Lost the challenge, so instead of being up 1-0 with the challenge brick, he's down 1-1. No challenge to go the rest of the match. Kind of a questionable decision there whether to throw the brick at that point, but they threw it, and of course lost a challenge. And usually when there's two athletes of this caliber, 5 minutes and 45 seconds to go, there's usually going to be a call that could prove to be pretty pivotal. And that's what we saw, 37 seconds to go. Burroughs was up 4 with a little bit over a minute to go, 6-2. Chamizo got a takedown. It's another flurry where Burroughs was in kind of a in on a double a little bit. It creates this flurry where they go out of bounds. And Burroughs looked to me like, and I didn't get a great view of it. I don't know that anybody got a great view of it because it was opposite of where the map or where the camera was. It's on the complete opposite side. They gave Chamizo 4 on it. I didn't think it was 4. I was shocked to see that they gave him 4. That's where it would have been nice for Burroughs to have that, that challenge brick at that point. But, so Chamizo gets the 4. He goes up 8-6 at that point and then has the advantage because of the 4-pointer. Burroughs tacked on. Actually, Chamizo got another takedown after that. No, excuse me. Let me rewind. The 4 put Chamizo up 8-8 on criteria because it was a 2 for Burroughs, a 4 for Chamizo. Chamizo was up 8-8. He scored a takedown right after that. And then Burroughs got a couple caution points to make it 10-10. But incredible match. Great action. Be nice if we could see like a best out of 7 from them. But
well, and to go back to a comment you made about when Jordan Burroughs came from behind to beat Chamizo at the Beat the Streets, you had just made a remark that that really isn't indicative of what it might look like at the Worlds or another competition because the mats were so wet.
Oh, yeah.
Taking now that we just have a clean match, what did you see that was different than Beat the Streets?
Well, Burroughs got to him earlier in the match. That was different. It was actually in some ways kind of a flip-flop because Burroughs had to overcome a 4-point deficit late at Beat the Streets. Chamizo had to overcome a 4-point deficit late to win in Istanbul. Chamizo is an unbelievable scrambler. We knew that going in. I think that was emphasized even more in that match on Saturday. I think Burroughs will make some adjustments. He's not really getting blown off his feet by Frank Chamizo, but some of those points are occurring. Like that big flurry, the 4-point flurry, the difference maker in the match occurred in a reversal type of scramble situation after Burroughs had scored two. So we'll be interesting to see the adjustments that are made. I think the one thing that Burroughs is yet to do, if I'm not mistaken, he hasn't turned him yet. And that's getting to that ankle lace, takedown to turn. Transition is one of Jordan Burroughs' strong suits. But he might have to go at things a little bit differently in the next go round. I'm totally fascinated by this matchup. I think you're talking about two of maybe the 5, 6, 7 best pound for pound guys in the world. And two all-time greats when you're talking about Burroughs with 5 World and Olympic titles, Chamizo with 2 of them, Chamizo coming up from winning a world title in 2015 at 65 kilos. Now he goes up in 2017 to 70 kilos, wins a world title there. Now making his way up to an Olympic weight and pretty fascinating stuff, Kyle.
Breaking it down a little bit further, Thomas Gilman wins gold, Kyle Dake wins gold, David Taylor wins gold, and then we talk about pound-for-pound greatest wrestlers in the world, maybe the best in the world. Kyle Snyder drops a match and then comes back for bronze. Nick Gwizdowski gets bronze. Let's just paint an overall picture from you, because I just didn't have a chance to watch any of the matches. You had a chance to watch some of those matches. Is it the performance we needed heading into the World Championships?
Well, the great part about it is we got, 80 days almost, I think our countdown to Budapest as we record this is right around 80, 81 days. So a lot of time left. United States had a training camp out in Colorado Springs before the trip over to Turkey. Didn't quite see maybe the pop and kind of snap and conditioning advantage that the United States ought to have in this format. You would think that the switch over to 2-day format, day of weigh-ins, would favor the United States because of how the system for weigh-ins is here for our high school and at the high school and college levels. We didn't really see that bear itself out in Turkey, but I think it looked like a team that maybe wasn't quite as fresh as you would hope for at least. I expect them to be more fresh when they get to Budapest. I expect them to be ready to roll, and just seemed like they were a little off. I think we're going to see better performances from James Green, from Jaden Cox, from Logan Stieber. I think we'll see better performances from them. I think Nashawn Garrett has a high ceiling. He went 0-1 at that tournament, got eliminated. All three of those guys wrestled, if I'm not mistaken, wrestled one match and they were done. Be interesting to hear what some of the guys on the team say about their performance and about what Bill Zadek has to say about the performance of the team as a whole. But from a positive standpoint, man, David Taylor was awesome. To pin your way through in an international tournament of that caliber, 4 falls. Kyle Dake had what? He had 2 or 3, I think. I think those two guys, was it Daniel Cormier said he didn't know if he had that many falls in 8 years on the international circuit, that he tweeted that out. Yeah. So
Let's just hope we get Yazdani Taylor. We just need to have that at some point. I think that would really make for a great, great drama, just a great showdown. I think we need that at the World Championships. I'm hoping for it.
Yeah, what's incredible is the fact that David Taylor, outside, if I'm not missing something, and I don't think I am, nothing's come to my mind in the time that I've thought about this, but outside of that one night in Lincoln, Nebraska, a year ago in June, he hasn't lost in the last 2 years.
Yeah, and he pinned Yazdani at the World Cup.
Yep. Yeah. He beat two Olympic champions that day. I think he rolled up Sharifov that same day over there, if I'm not mistaken. And he has put it on some pretty high-level contestants in the last couple of years. So it's not like he is skated by just wrestling second-tier, third-tier guys around the world.
He could be the show this year. He could be the guy that we want to watch. I know I want to watch him. I'm absolutely thrilled to see him in his first world championship. I think he would probably be, at this point, the guy that intrigues me the most on what's going to be his outcome.
One of.
Yeah, yeah. I'm just picking like, my number one at this point. That could change, but he's the guy that I'm most curious about because of what you said, just the domination and where is he going to be able to play out in all of this in his first world championship. I think he's going to do well.
I think you could go up and down the lineup and say that about just about every guy. There's tremendous upside from 57 to 125. It's a lineup where every guy on that team, in my opinion, is capable of winning a medal. There's not one guy that I would say this guy doesn't have a chance to win a medal. That being said, there's also some questions somewhere along the way. A lot of questions along the way, 1 through 10, and a lot of those are just attributed to the level of wrestling around the world and some of the guys that they're gonna run into. Gilman, we've seen him go through a little bit of slump. He kind of alluded to an injury that he dealt with coming off of or leading up to the World Cup in the months leading up to the World Cup in between Paris and then the World Cup in Iowa City. Really didn't want to talk a whole lot about it, but you read between the lines and that's kind of what he was hinting at. And so we didn't see the best of Thomas Gilman in the winter months or in the early spring, I should say, the World Cup and then down at the Pan Ams. But looks like he's starting to get it back together. He beat some pretty high-level guys. Süleyman Atli of Turkey was a European bronze medalist. Gilman beat him, I think, in the quarterfinals, then beat a Ukrainian in the semis who beat Andrei Yatchenko, who lost to Gilman in the first round last year and then went on. Gilman pulled him back in. Yatchenko went on and won the bronze. So there were some pretty high caliber guys at 57 kilos. And then, so I think that's a big positive for the United States too, seeing Thomas Gilman move in the right direction again.
Another topic of conversation is Frank Chamizo, who's from Cuba, went to Italy. Now it's part of the New York Wrestling Club. And this just opens up a further conversation just about even the history of Americans or foreigners coaching other foreigners. And I just go back to Bill Smith, the 1972 Olympics. Bill Smith was a 1952 Olympic gold medalist for the United States. Two-time NCAA champion for the University of Northern Iowa, coached the Canadian Olympic team in 1972. And you can go on and on about different scenarios where this has happened. I think Sergei Belaglazov was a resident coach for USA Wrestling for, I think, a year or two. There's been other examples of that. I think there's talk about this right now as we look at Kendall Cross now coaching Frank Chamizo. Is this the right move for Kendall Cross to be coaching a foreign opponent to beat potentially Jordan Burroughs?
It's a question I threw out there on Twitter the other day. That was my initial reaction when we got the news that Frank Chamizo was coming to train out of the NYC RTC. And I threw it out there. I said, taking the temperature on this one, are you cool with Frank Chamizo training in an American-based club? By and large, the response was yes. Now, there were some people that... there were a few no's in there, but the vast majority of people were all for it. And again, small sample size. That's just a really small segment of the wrestling population that I think there were about 25 responses or something along those lines. But a lot of different ways to look at this.
Even though a small sample size, I am surprised by that. I would have thought it had been the exact opposite. For whatever reason, I just thought that people would get on board up with that. And I don't know what the reaction was when there was potential that Jordan Burroughs was possibly going to wrestle for an Iranian Club Cup team. I think there was just some outpouring of negativity, some people saying that he's an American, he should never do that. Ultimately, Jordan Burroughs did not do that. I know this isn't the same situation, but there are a few parallels here about what does that mean when you're training another opponent who happens to be wrestling for the country that you represented at some point. In this case, Kendall Cross won an Olympic gold medal for the United States. I'm not necessarily against it, but I would be interested to know what the comments were from the people that are.
Yeah, so I think there, you, as you mentioned, you laid it out, there are a lot of illustrations here, a lot of examples through the years, as well as recently. I mean, Taha Akgul, the three-time world and Olympic champion from Turkey, coming in to train with Kyle Snyder on a fairly regular basis. He's been over a couple times. So I think there are a lot of different shades to how you want to color this. And the thing with Chamizo, you're talking about prior to his arrival full-time at the NYC RTC, you have to identify him as one of maybe two or three of the greatest threats to Burroughs is thrown at 74 kilograms. So I think that there's some feeling amongst the American wrestling community that this is good. It's great to have a guy of that level training alongside Americans in New York City. There's also a school of thought that kind of feels like this is a slap in the face of a guy who has been one of the best ambassadors that our sport has seen in the United States. So a lot of different ways to look at it. And I think
fascinating.
I think it's an interesting conversation.
Yeah, it's a great conversation because regardless of anything, Jordan Burroughs is going to have to beat Frank Chamizo. Likely, if you don't know what side of the bracket you get, there's so many variables, especially at the World Championships, the way it's set up now. But as far as stylistically, if you just look at it from potential, Kendall Cross is an ideal fit for Frank Chamizo, the way both of those guys wrestle. Very similar in the way they execute their counter defense. And you just look at some of those matches that Kendall Cross had during the Olympic Games. Hey, Kendall Cross is the right guy to train a guy like Frank Chamizo. Given their styles and just their ability to get to that next level, I think Kendall Cross is an ideal fit for what he can do to bring out the best. Now, on that same token, if you just take other sports, I think we're in an environment now where there's more of an international flavor, especially in a sport like basketball, where you see this as commonplace. I think maybe with wrestling, it's taking a new form and we're not used to it because it is a combat sport. And you take a guy like Conor McGregor from Ireland, I'm sure he got trained by a multitude of different people. You come and train in the United States, vice versa. I think this is just maybe a little bit new for wrestling, and we're having a little bit of an adjustment period.
Could be. I think the big thing, though, to me is just I keep going back to the reason that this is a hot topic. Chamizo's not a run-of-the-mill guy. He's not a guy that is maybe going to sneak onto the podium and or be in the mix to win a bronze. And Burroughs isn't a guy that's trying to cut his teeth and move his way up the ladder either. You're talking about, as I said before, maybe the greatest threat at 74 kilograms to a guy that is trying to tie John Smith this year for the most world and Olympic titles in United States history. So
based on that, is it because he's a threat? So let's just throw in a couple more examples, just even one locally here. Alex Dolly wrestled for Team Ireland, and I don't think anyone probably thought he was a threat to Jake Herbert, even though he happened to place higher at the 2015 World Championships, just because Dolly won a match and Herbert lost his first match. no one was getting too upset about that particular scenario. And we talked about Mark Perry being an example too, but you felt that was a little bit different at 2015 for Mark Perry to wear Team Bulgaria gear because he had a built-in relationship.
Yeah, I think so. I think that that's one way that that a lot of people are looking at it is we had Sean Bormet on this show here a couple weeks ago, and he's got Stevan Micic competing for Serbia. And
yeah,
you're not going to expect his college coach to turn his back on him, right? And not coach him.
Yeah, I would hope not. I think that's a built-in fit, but
it's fascinating, this one feels a little bit different, though. It feels a little bit different.
Delve into why. Just because of that built-in relationship that you talked about. So Mark Perry with Novochkov coached him in college, and so that makes it okay for him to wrestle or to coach for Team Bulgaria. Why is this not a built-in relationship? Because there wasn't enough time? I mean, let's just go through the scenario.
Well, I think it wasn't. It's a little bit different in that Chamizo was already one of the top guys in the world. He'd already won two world titles before the alliance was formed here.
And another, right? Well, yeah. And so Franklin Gomez being another example.
It's another example.
Yeah, for Puerto Rico. So, I think we're
like
not
I said,
hear the
I
last
think,
of this.
I think that they're are a lot of different shades in how this is colored.
And which shade do you think it is right now? Do you think it's more?
You're trying to pin me down, aren't you?
I am a little bit, and I'm okay. I'm just trying to just widen our scope of what this looks like.
I don't know. What are you asking me, Kyle? What are you asking me?
I'm asking you to go on records on what you feel about this situation.
I'm going to write that, how I feel about it.
You are? Okay.
I'm going to write about this piece or this topic and look at all of the different angles and hear some more voices in it. I don't know that 24 or 25 comments on Twitter is enough for me to really gather all the information that I want to gather on it. But I do. I think it's a really fascinating story, and I want to hear Kendall Cross's thoughts on it. I want to hear Jordan Burroughs's thoughts on it. I want to hear some thoughts of people that are totally independent that don't have a horse in the race.
I'd like to hear Rich Bender's thoughts on it too.
Bill Zadek?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be
it's
fascinating to get his take, Bill Zadek especially. And just see if he would go on record with a quote. And maybe when you write your story, I don't know if you're going to delve into those peoples and those players in this story. But I think there's so many angles here that that you can explore that make this one of the best storylines of the year.
Hey, and then the other school of thought here in some ways is Chamizo's got to train somewhere. Is he better off training in the NYC RTC? Is that better for Burroughs? That he's over here in the States and people get passed through there, maybe get a more of a feel for him. I doubt that Burroughs is ever going to get his hands on Chamizo again before the World Championships. But is Frank Chamizo better off being in New York City, or is he better off training over in Russia and having all the Russians get a feel for him and what he can do and where he's good and maybe where he's slightly vulnerable a little bit? Again, this one's really fascinating to me, this whole story.
Our guest today is the current Greco-Roman national team coach for USA Wrestling. Has some nice credentials behind his name, Olympic silver medalist in 2000 and a 2001 world silver medalist, Matt Lindland, our guest. How are you, Matt?
So well, gentlemen. Thank you for having me on.
Hey, countdown to the World Championships. How are you feeling about the Greco team?
Well, I think we're making progress. I think we're on track. We got a great plan, and we're moving forward. We just got back from our first camp, which was out in Oregon in my hometown, and Vegas, and we leave Sunday for that first phase, and then we follow that up. We get back from that camp, recover the guys a little bit, and then we take them over to Germany on the 15th of August for the Grand Prix, and it's in Germany, 17 and 18.
Why'd you decide to go to different spots? I would think that camps would be in Colorado Springs. Why go to Vegas and Oregon?
Well, first of all, the one in Oregon, one of our donors gives us beautiful strength facility, bought us a brand new mat out there, and gives us access to his guest home where we can house the entire team. And it actually is a really great environment for the athletes to train in. And, you know, we're in the wilderness, and it's incredibly important to connect with nature and, you know, stay grounded out there in nature. There's very little distractions in Eagle Creek, Oregon. The reason for going to Vegas is because we did not have enough. It's a high volume time in the summer for camps at the training center. We didn't have space at the Olympic Training Center to house our athletes. We have a combined junior and senior world team training camp. And so we're going out to South Point where they got space for us.
Going to your career, you are known for your Greco-Roman success, but also your mixed martial arts success. You had several years where you were fighting in the UFC and then came back as the national team coach for Greco-Roman wrestling. How did you stay current during that time? How did you kind of keep up on what was going on in Greco?
Say that one more time.
You went into mixed martial arts for several years. And during that time, there, you were not competing in Greco or coaching in Greco, and then you went to be the national team coach. How did you stay current with Greco-Roman wrestling so that you could be effective at your job right now?
Well, I did want to take a little break from Greco-Roman for a while, you know, and then I missed the sport. I missed being around, mixed martial arts kind of turned into a more of an entertainment than a sport, I felt like. And I started getting back into coaching at my junior college, which is, you know, just outside of my hometown there. You know, and I lived in Eagle Creek, you know, it was 20 minutes for me to get to my junior college. So it wasn't too much of a stretch for me to, start heading up there once or twice a week and running to practice or, you know, just working with the athletes until next thing you know, I'm traveling, I'm on the road. I bought you a ticket. And are you going with us to the regionals, the nationals? And I just got a lot more involved. And so I started, you know, working with our junior college athletes. And, you know, I got a number of athletes that, you know, had a desire to continue competing after the folk style season. So we had 8 athletes that committed to competing in the junior trials to make the junior team. And so once I got the commitment, I put a plan together and ran a training camp. We had 8 weeks because the junior colleges finishes in a little earlier time frame. So we were able to rest those guys after their long, grueling folk style season, bring them back. It was a 6-week camp was all it was. It wasn't 8 weeks. It was 6 weeks. I wished I had 8. I had 8 between the tournament, but I rested the guys a little bit and then tapered them at the end. But I took 8 of those guys out there. 7 of them were all Americans in that first year. And then the next year I got involved with, I got brought on as the volunteer coach for the 2013 world team. I started getting back involved and then that job opened up and it just seemed like the right time for me with my kids both starting their own careers. And, you know, my daughter was still, had 2 more years of college, but she'd been doing her own thing for a couple of years and she'd actually moved back home with us. But, when we told her we were going to Colorado, she was all on board 100%. And my son had a job and was doing his own thing. So I think this job would for me and my priorities in life, I think it would have been impossible for me to do this job with 2 young kids. So I think just timing, and getting back involved at the right time. I think I just started getting back involved with, you know, working with athletes at the junior college level and then moving on to the senior world team. And it seemed like a really good fit. So
how do you stay current with all of the rule changes? It seems like Greco really does change a lot with rules. How do you just stay in that cycle and keep up with everything?
Well, that's interesting you say that because when I came back into the sport, you know, I was like, wait a minute, what's going on here? I mean, it's all a parterre game now. You know, they took the sport away and tried to destroy it a little bit, in my opinion. But I just think, you know, now they do change the rules a lot. I think we want to make our sport more exciting, more attractive to a broader audience, not just the hardcore fans. And you just got to adapt. You got to adjust. You got to adapt. You got to pay attention to what's going on. You got to, you know, follow the sport and stay current. But I think there's certain principles that don't change. I think there's a lot of fundamentals and principles that you have to understand. Our sport's different than freestyle and folk style, which our country is really accustomed to and familiar with, which we don't attack and drive through things too often. Well, most of our scores are behind us. We lock and we execute techniques that are behind us, or we backstep and change the direction and score our points. But, so fundamentally it's a different type of scoring system, really, but there's some truths that don't change. But definitely there's some changes in the rules. There has been consistently changes over the last years. But I think we've gotten to a point where hopefully these are the rules we're going to carry through the games in 2020.
Matt, if you were in charge, if you had a magic wand to devise a rule set that is more attractive to a larger audience, what would those rules look like?
I don't know if I go down that road. I like the current rules. I really do. It encourages action. It still has parterre, which I mean, personally, I'm a big fan of parterre. I was, I made a career out of lifting guys and throwing them on their heads. But I think the roots of our sport is to take a opponent down to his back and try to pin him. And from there, you should be able to have an opportunity in parterre. I don't know if I go back and forth because I love the art of parterre. But I don't know if it's the most purest thing. I think you should have to earn parterre. And I guess right now they have a mechanism in place that allows you to earn it if there's no scoring on the feed. So I think we're getting really close to having really good rule set. We just got to get the officials consistently calling it the same, you know, across the world. As we do, you know, and we've always had this problem. It catches up. It's a European sport, and it catches up later in the United States. Our officials catch on later, and they don't necessarily call the things like they are in Europe until a year or two later, and then they start seeing it. And then by that time, like you mentioned, you know, they're changing the rules again. So it does make things difficult. But I personally like the rules right now, and I don't know if I'm the right guy to decide what rule sets there are.
Where do Greco-Roman wrestlers come from? Andy and I were talking about this because they don't take the traditional path. And you can point to Northern Michigan now, but take a guy like Jermail Byers. He wrestled, I don't even know if he wrestled there, but he went to North Carolina A&T. I don't know what about his college background. Some of these guys come through the ranks and they're successful. They aren't your college stars. How do you make a trajectory to get to be good at Greco-Roman wrestling?
What would be the ideal trajectory for Greco-Roman wrestling?
Sure.
I think you focus on pure athletics. So you're probably a cadet, you start wrestling, and by the time you're a cadet, you start focusing on one style. And Greco-Roman is, like I said, it's mostly a European sport, so you've got to get overseas, you've got to see the competition, you've got to train with the rest of the world and see what they're doing. So, you know, this last year, we had one weekend where we had 108 athletes from junior age and below in Europe. I think that was a critical, you know, component to what we're trying to do. We're trying to get our athletes overseas, experience the world, you know? I mean, what better education do you get than traveling the world, learning how to figure out things on your own, but also figuring out what the rest of the world is doing in wrestling and how they compete? Because, yeah, like you said, I mean, it's different path here in the United States because we don't have enough clubs that are focused on Greco-Roman. We have a few. That's their priority. And we have a few others that include Greco-Roman, but I think our country's really put a lot of emphasis on college wrestling and the folk style system. And that seems to be a major priority for a lot of coaches. And if that's the coach's priority, well, then that becomes the athlete's priority. I grew up in a system, and in my, you know, I started wrestling in high school. What did we do? We did like 4 weeks in seventh grade. I did 4 weeks in eighth grade, and then we didn't wrestle. That was it. Like, okay, here's wrestling. And it was folk style. And they introduced us to the sport. And then when I got into high school, again, it was folk style. And then I went to a tournament. It was freestyle, and Roman Greco, as my high school coach called it. He's like, here's a Roman Greco thing. I was like, well, it says Greco-Roman, but whatever. You know, so, you know, they just, the coaches, a lot of the high school coaches aren't even engaged with our sport. They don't understand what the pinnacle of our sport is. So it's a lot of education of the coaches. But what happened to me was I went to that tournament, and somehow I went 0-8 in 1 weekend. I wrestled both international styles, freestyle and Greco. I wrestled both age divisions, Greco-Roman and freestyle and cadet and junior. And I didn't win a match. And I looked over the podium and saw, you know, what uniforms everybody that was standing on the podium was wearing. There was two different clubs. I picked the one that was closest to me, which took me from my high school. I had to get on a bus, transfer at the Clackamas Town Center, get on another bus. Once I got off that bus, it was about a mile walk to my club. And the other club was a little farther and deeper into Portland. But, you know, I made that commitment every day until I was able to drive. And then I drove to my club. But, you know, I showed up there, and there was multiple guys that had been on Olympic teams, world teams. We even had one guy that was a three-time Olympian. Mark Fuller was at my club at the time. Pavel Kotzin was the coach of the 84 Olympic team. This was 1985. I show up at that club, and they're teaching Greco-Roman. And I got involved. And my coaches never really – they never talked about winning state titles or becoming Division I All-Americans. All we talked about was the pinnacle of our sport, which was getting to the Olympic Games and getting a medal at the Olympic Games. So I think we're doing a disservice to our athletes by not – showing them what the pinnacle of our sport is and what to aspire to. And it's hard because you're right. The Olympics only happens every 4 years. So, you know, and we have a system in the United States where you get an opportunity to wrestle all the time. But I think athletes are getting too many matches too early. Bill Zadig talks about this 10-year window. I don't know if you ever heard his theory on that, where you only got like 10 years to really do this. And do you want to pick those 10 years between 6 and 16 or 16 to 26? You know, I mean, I think there's something to be said for that. You know, I started at 15 and, you know, found my way to the, you know, to the podium a couple times at, you know, world championships and Olympic Games. But I didn't get an opportunity to win state titles. But that was never a goal for me. That was never a priority.
There's such a unique difference between freestyle wrestlers and Greco-Roman wrestlers in my mind whenever I'm around that group or Greco-Roman wrestlers. It just seems like it's different conversations, different feel. You've been in that environment your whole life. What makes a Greco-Roman wrestler different mentally than a freestyle wrestler?
I don't know if I see that big a difference, to tell you the truth. I think it takes all the things that, the same things. You have to be focused on your craft. You got to be dedicated to your art and disciplined, and you have to work hard, and you can't let the, I mean, especially at the senior level, the life starts to get going. And, you know, I mean, there's a lot of athletes. There's only one athlete on my team that two athletes on my team that have, you know, families, you know, where they have kids and a wife. And I think you can look at that in two ways. I think you can look at it and say, wow, this is, I got to focus on this because I can't do wrestling, or I need to focus on my family. So I have to be successful at wrestling. If I want to do this, I have to put everything into it and give everything I have, every opportunity, because my family, you know, my livelihood and the way I feed my kids, you know, really depends on this. But I don't know if I see that big of a difference. I mean, I wrestled internationally in freestyle. I was a Pan American champion in freestyle, and you know, beat a world medalist to do that. I didn't stick with the freestyle side because I enjoyed Greco-Roman more, and I felt like I would be more successful doing what I enjoyed more. So, I mean, I think that was why I chose Greco-Roman, but I could see me sticking with freestyle and fitting in there. I mean,
yeah.
I don't know if I see that big a difference. What, tell me what you mean.
Well,
what's different?
I guess, from what I see, there's just this kind of innate brotherhood that Greco-Roman wrestling has, that they're maybe just a little bit tighter and they have kind of not a chip on their shoulder, but it's like, hey, we're in this together, that we're truly part of a team, whereas a lot of these freestyle guys come from college programs, and that's pretty apparent when they come into the freestyle system. And I think it's different now. I think that they're as much of a unit as they've ever been, but it seems like the Greco-Roman unit is singularly unique in international wrestling.
Well, we are starting to build some of our RTCs in Greco-Roman, and that's definitely a long-term goal. I think we're really strong at Cornell now. We got a senior world team member, junior world team member. They got an incoming freshman that was on our cadet team. So they've kind of covered the bases there. Utah Valley's become strong in Greco-Roman. And, you know, we got Nate Engel out at Stanford, and we're going to start building that program. Brian Medlin's at Illinois. So, I mean, maybe those similarities will start to be more apparent as we start to build Greco-Roman within the RTCs that are currently existing. But I think what maybe you're thinking about is, I think there's a lot of coaches out there, you know, at the younger age groups that don't really see the value in Greco-Roman. So they don't teach it because their priorities, like I said, are winning state titles and sending their athletes to, you know, big time 4-year college programs. I don't know if that's the best path for a Greco-Roman wrestler to deviate from his art and his craft to go wrestle a style that's completely different in the approach, in the way you approach it. So I think the most direct path, especially now when you look at the average age of a world and Olympic medalist, it just in 2012 was 26 years old, and in 2016 that dropped 4 years in one quad. The average age dropped 4 years. So now we're looking at our average age of our medalists is now 22. Some of these guys aren't even out of college by the time they're 22. And if they're not practicing their craft while, you know, in college, there's an opportunity to be a dual path athlete where you can go to the college system, still train Greco-Roman. I mean, we saw Colton Schultz, he's going to do that. I think it's a lot easier at heavyweight. Those guys don't attack the legs too much anyway, but I think it's a lot harder path.
Do you feel like Greco-Roman got slighted out of the new Final X format, or are you fine with how it went down? You didn't.
That was my decision to try to build these RTC programs, attract freestyle guys over to our sport that maybe didn't have an opportunity to make it to the Final X. You know, there was 4 weeks in between where they selected their top two guys. And we were actively trying to recruit some of those guys. I just think that it's such a different sport that it's really hard to get some of these guys that are really entrenched in their freestyle to come on over. But I mean, in the past, certainly guys that didn't make a team in either style had that opportunity to try their other style. You know, okay, I didn't make the team in freestyle. Well, I can certainly try to make a team in Greco. And we wanted to create that opportunity. We didn't want to limit opportunities. So we held our procedure different. You know, Final X was, you know, we did that in 2015 at Cornell. I don't know if you remember that or not, but we had a 2 out of 3 type of format in 2015. So, and this was something that we did earlier. That was the year after I started as a national coach. I felt like we could try to do something like that. I like it. I like the format. I like putting our best athletes, you know, and showcasing them, putting them on a mat and broadcasting it and showcasing our athletes. I think that was a positive thing across the board. And it looks like probably this next year we're going to head that direction as well.
Let's talk bookends on your Greco-Roman world team. Let's start with the lightest weight class. Sam Hayswinkle, at the age of 35, makes a world team in Greco-Roman wrestling, something he had not done. He made an Olympic team in freestyle, but comes back at 35. Did you see this coming?
I knew he was showing up at our trials. I knew he was a contender. I mean, he was top two on our national team a couple of years back. Sam Hayswinkle is definitely not somebody you want to overlook. And I don't think anybody did, but I don't know if that was the guy I was predicting, but, I don't know if there was any guy. I mean, it's a new weight class. It was a brand new weight class. So I don't know if anybody had really established themselves there at 55 kilos yet.
And then go to super heavyweight. Adam Kuhn turns it around, beats Robbie Smith in the best out of three, losing to him at the U.S. Open, where Robbie Smith really did dominate him. What did Adam Kuhn do right to turn the tables and make that team?
Adam's an intelligent man. He put together a strategy, a plan, and he focused on that plan and used his size, used his length. He got his legs underneath him a lot better and was able to create more angles and not let Robbie push him off the mat. I think he was coming straight off of a folk style. This is somebody that, like I mentioned before, that at heavyweight can be a dual sport athlete, can go, okay, I can do folk style, and when that's over, I can transition into Greco-Roman. And he did very well. He wasn't a novice, though. This is somebody that's, proven himself at the highest levels. He was a junior world medalist in the past. So I don't think it was a big stretch to get Adam Kuhn to wrestle Greco-Roman. For him to take out Robbie Smith was quite a task, I think. And he had his hands full, and he handled it very well. We're really pleased to have Adam on our team and Sam, because they're both great leaders in our program. We have a lot of young guys in our program, and they need to see the examples of what, men like this do right, what they do differently than maybe what they're doing, potentially off the mat.
Matt, you look at your team, and Ellis Coleman and Giangelo Hancock are carryovers from Paris. Everybody else is new. Did you see that kind of turnover coming, and what do you attribute that to?
Yeah, I think I did. I think I was anticipating, and I was kind of wondering when that was going to happen. I was surprised it hadn't happened earlier. New coach in the program and a whole new team. I don't think that's a surprise. The young guys, they're young. These guys are young, and this is a young man's sport. I touched base on this earlier. This isn't outside of Sam Hayeswinkle, who kind of throws the whole thing off, and we discussed why that weight class, particularly, it's a new weight class, he was capable of doing that there. But I think it's a young man's sport, and we've got a lot of young guys on our team, and they have to be capable at a younger age now, because the average age is moving down. So we've got to get these guys into a Greco-Roman path sooner. We've got to get them training in the right system. We've got to get them the right competitions and the right camps. And then they're going to be able to put themselves in a position not only to make a team, but to compete at the world level and come home with medals.
Who trains the way you want? I mean, who on the team kind of embodies the way you want them to train and can be the leader as a reflection of your training mentality?
You want me to go up and down the lineup with each individual?
I mean, if you want to, or just pick that guy that is going to be the focal point and a guy you can point to.
I think we're developing really good leaders on this program. Right now, at our first camp, we broke our guys up into leadership groups based on the days they compete. So day one athletes were in one group, and Sam Hayeswinkle was a leader of that group. Adam Kuhn was a leader, and Kamal Bay was a leader. And behind those guys, we saw guys like Jesse Filkey, who's, stepping up big time. He's one of the veterans on the team, and Ellis Coleman. Those two guys were not designated leaders, but they led by example, and they did an outstanding job of supporting their group leaders within their groups. So, I mean, right there, I mean, I just named five guys that are doing a really good job of demonstrating what we're looking for and leading by example, but also, sharing the message, communication. We came up with a list at this last camp about the five things that we need to get better as a program. And the athletes developed this list. It wasn't something that, I handed down to these guys. It was something we discussed and the athletes came up with. And the first one on that list is a sense of urgency. The second one is communication. The third one was accountability and professionalism, being a professional athlete, what that takes and holding yourself accountable first. And then you have the ability to hold your teammates accountable. So I think those are really important things that the guys were starting to understand what they needed to do as far as off the mat. And we discussed that, these guys are true warriors. And every warrior coach culture throughout history, throughout periods of time, I mean, and even in modern warrior culture, you have Marines and they have different code than the Navy SEALs and the Army. But these guys, when you look at warrior codes, what those guys talk about is they talk about virtue. They talk about character and virtue. And it's a little different than what you would typically think. Well, we need to fight hard. We need to, do this or that on the mat. But it's really to protect themselves from themselves and from the enemies as well, which is to have, good character and to have true virtues. And I don't know if we spend it. I don't know in our education system if we actually teach virtue anymore in the public school systems.
Matt, last time we talked face to face, I think was in Poland after the U-23s, and culture was a huge part of that conversation. And you're talking about some culture stuff right now. When you step back from that tournament, what were things that you immediately went to work on to try to improve that culture?
Building character, talking about virtue. Those are exactly what we discussed over there. I don't think these young athletes realize the gravity of the situation they're in. I mean, they're representing the United States of America. They're representing USA Wrestling and they're representing the Greco-Roman program. All of those things are first and foremost before they're representing themselves. And I think we got to be professional and hold ourselves accountable. And I think the guys are starting to recognize that. That's why I said when we came up with these lists, it wasn't something that I said. I was like, spread some papers around. Let's think about this on our own. Everybody write down, what are the five things? And pretty much those themes were coming up across. And so when we had our discussions, those were the five things that we came up with that we want to get better at. And all those things kind of deal with that virtue.
You seem like you're an interesting guy to me in that you're pretty diverse in what you've done, mixed martial arts, wrestling. You've been in some film and television. I think you were actually going to run for public office. I don't know if you did, but you were considering it. What kind of makes you tick and want to just put you?
And I'm a three-sport professional athlete. You left out that I raced professional whitewater.
Okay, see, there you go. You're just making my point even more, just in that you are diverse and you just do a lot of different things. Where did that come from? Why do you want to put your finger in so many projects?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know if I want to put myself in so many different projects as I'm just a bit of a polygeist. I feel. Like I want to experience more. I want to learn more. I want to constantly study. And I mean, I read a lot of philosophy and I don't know. I ran for office because we didn't have a good candidate in my district. And I care about our community and I run a martial arts school in Portland, Oregon. And our mission is to empower the people in our community and just to make the world a better place. And within that, I think you got to find peace in yourself. And what brings, you know, what brings me peace is when I was on the mat and when I was in the cage is I found peace in those moments of chaos. And whitewater, I ran my first 30-foot waterfall on the 4th of July this year in a kayak. I told you I raced professionally in a rubber boat. I was on a team of 2, 4, 6 different paddlers in a big rubber raft. And now I'm taking up kayaking and I've got a world-class coach and I've paddled with multiple Olympic medalists. And we ran waterfalls together, you know, and
wow.
But I really think having, you know, having structure and having a plan and being disciplined is critical. You have to have those things to be successful, but you also have to have one foot in chaos at the same time. And chaos is combat. Any kind of combat is absolute chaos. And I think whitewater is chaos as well. Politics is chaos. That's why I stepped into there. But you don't want to go into those chaotic situations without having structure and discipline. First and foremost, I think you want to have a plan. You want to be disciplined. But at the same time, I think we crave that chaos. You know, it's funny because, you know, in my former life as a martial arts athlete and a gym owner, my employees, they call me the Hurricane. Cause like the more that there was chaos and the more shit that was going on around us, it was like the more I was able to focus and lead. It's like, it's really paradoxical, isn't it? That the more chaos there is, the more I'm able to focus. But at the same time, I want to have a plan. I want to have structure and I want to have discipline. It is. It's very paradoxical. And I think you picked up on that.
Hey, what happened in 2000 when you had to go to the courts to make the Olympic team against Keith Siraki?
Is this a 3-hour podcast?
Well, maybe the highlights. I just know I've heard a lot about it, and I've just never heard from you about it. Just I think that there was a illegal move or use his legs, and you went to court. You re-wrestled the match. Just wondering what transpired there.
Okay, well, when you go into a trials procedure or you go into a world team or Olympic team trials procedures, there are protocols and in place. There are rules that we have to adhere to and follow. We went into the match. The rules were not handled appropriately. I went to my process and said I can protest this match based on misapplication of the rules, and I was denied my due process. Because of that, they said that I could not review the match, and because it was based on judgment, and this wasn't judgment; it was a pure misapplication. Can you foul somebody in Greco-Roman or not? That's not a judgment call. That's a misapplication. I was denied that right to review, have the film reviewed. So I went to the second phase of that process, which was Greco-Roman Sports Committee hearing. During that process, there was members pulled off of my committee because they may have had bias. I think everybody has bias. We all have bias. That's why you put a committee together instead of one individual. You put multiple people on there and you call it a committee because everybody has bias and you make that best decision. I was denied that due process as well because they pulled committee members off. So my final opportunity was to go to arbitration. Arbitration is in definition is final and binding. The arbitrator ruled that the match should be re-wrestled. I re-wrestled the match, beat Keith Siraki 9-0. And I would not get named to the Olympic team. Then we went back to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. That judge decided to uphold the procedures that were in place. Not some procedures I made up, the procedures that were in place before I participated in those trials, and was told to, you know, put my name on the Olympic team. That didn't happen. During that time, there was a re-arbitration, which is kind of an oxymoron since arbitration is final and binding. So that was ruled that it didn't happen. Finally, the case went to the United States Supreme Court. They upheld the ruling of the Ninth Circuit. I was named to the team the day that we left for processing, and the next day we headed to Australia. So it was a stressful situation. But
how'd you train? How did you train through that?
I had great coaches. Mark Cody was my coach during that time. My personal coach got me prepared, got me ready. I had incredible training partners, and I just stayed the course.
Have you talked to Keith since then?
I've talked to Keith since then. I don't see him too often. He lives in Colorado, but he's like an hour from town here up in the mountains, doing his thing. But yeah, I mean, it's not personal. It's not against him. We fought on the mat, and then I fought the process, not him. I wasn't trying to keep him off a team. I was just trying to get on a team.
Now, hey, just to add to your legend here, there was a great story that Chael Sonnen told about you. I'm sure you saw this, but I just want to get your take on that story where I guess you challenged a Cuban to a fight outside the parking lot.
I did not challenge a Cuban to a fight outside. That
okay.
is absolutely not true.
But see, that's where I want to get the story from you.
Well, I actually don't think Chael told it that way either. And Chael did come to our camp in Oregon and retold this story. So I'm very familiar with this story. A Squee actually came and challenged me. I knocked his teeth out in the match.
Ah, okay.
And he said outside to a translator, "Hey, if you want to fight, I'll fight you." Well, he said a bunch of stuff, but that's really the only message I heard was, "If you want to fight, I'll fight you." I sat my bag down and said, "Let's go." And he said, no, I just don't want you to punch me when we're wrestling. And I said, I can't promise that. I might punch you if we're wrestling. I mean, it's a fight. And I'm going to do what I need to do to win this match within the rules. And there is some gray area within those rules. And I operated in the gray area. So I think that's the story that you're referring to.
Yeah, it is.
But yeah, this is a two-time Olympic champion that challenged me to fight. And then he chose not to fight. So, you know, I never lost him again. He dropped down a weight class, won another Olympic gold medal. And I had to wrestle their backup, who was just a world champion, to qualify the weight class in Columbia that year at the Pan Ams. And so I qualified the weight class and then almost didn't make it on the Olympic team. Yes.
So
you're bringing up a lot of history here.
Well, do a lot of people ask you about that once Chael went on record? And because he's a popular guy, did a lot of people ask you about that story?
I mean, it's been brought up. I started coaching Chael when I was 15 years old. And, we're still friends to this day. I mean, I love the kid. I mean, he's a known ped user. He's a convicted felon, but I love him regardless. I care a lot about him, but you know, he is a popular guy. He does a lot of things well and he does some things wrong, and he learns and he grows and he gets better from each of those experiences. And I appreciate Chael a lot.
All right. So just humor me here with this story now. Tali Thompson, who's a favorite of both of ours, super heavyweight. He's a world bronze medalist. He's an NCAA champion. Just tell us about the time you wrestled him when he first came into the program and what you did to Tali.
Well, he was what we refer to now as a gray shirt. We called it a construction shirt because he was putting roofs on houses that year and training with the club. And who just turned on all that music? Excuse me. So he was a freshman. He was just a little, like, 100 kilo freshman. And I was a senior. I was, one of the best guys in the country that year. And I torture him. And I come back 3 years later, and he's like, "I remembered everything you did to me." He was a fifth-year senior with a gray shirt year. So now he's like 130 kilos and total man, and he just wanted to torture me.
Hey, you have a lot more that you're going to accomplish. I know that you're the world team coach right now, but I'm excited to see what the next step is for Matt Lindland. It might be parasailing. It might be parachuting. I don't know, but I know there's some other tricks up your sleeve.
No, you know what? You know what? My wife and I have an agreement on parachuting.
What is it?
She wanted one thing, and I gave it to her. I said, unless she changes her mind, I don't ever get to jump out of a plane.
All right. So
she wanted one thing. I'm hucking myself over 30-foot waterfall. She gets a little nervous. I'm fighting people in an octagon. I'm willing to fight a 2-time Olympic champion in the streets of Puerto Rico. She wanted one thing. She's like, can you not jump out of the plane? I'm like, why that? She's just like, that's my thing. I'm like, all right. Well, you know what? I'm very blessed that I have a wonderful life that has completely supported me in everything that I've wanted to do in life. And without her, I would not be the success that I am. And I wouldn't be able to do what I love to do and follow my passions and follow my dreams. She had one rule while I was an athlete, and that was to have health insurance for her and the kids. I did that every year. I was on national team. We were provided elite athlete health insurance. And when I started fighting the UFC, I bought health insurance. So as long as I was able to keep health insurance, she said I could do whatever I wanted to for a career and follow my passions. And in my recreational time, she's only got one thing, and that's just don't jump out of airplanes. So, yeah, I don't think I got it too rough, to tell you the truth.
Hey, you're a special guy in this sport, Matt. We appreciate you coming on. We're going to be in Budapest, so maybe we can hang out there and walk the streets of Hungary.
I'm looking forward to doing it, guys. And appreciate you guys' time and having me on. And keep up the great work, guys.
Hey, we appreciate that. For Matt Lindland, Greco-Roman national team coach, and Andy Hamilton of TrackWrestling.com, I'm Kyle Klingman. You've been listening to On the Mat.
This show is part of the Matt Talk Podcast Network.
For more wrestling podcasts, head over to MattTalkOnline.com.